Good morning. For the students, just briefly, I will tell you that you're part of the 59th meeting of this court since 1987, when Tom Moyer became Chief Justice, the 59th time this court has met outside of the capital city. We are delighted that the Huron County Bar and judges have invited us here and made an opportunity available to us for you to see in person how the state's high court works. For the lawyers, I've explained, I will explain again briefly, due to the death of Chief Justice Moyer, we are now a court of six and will be until May 3rd. Every matter that is submitted to this court and has been submitted to this court while Tom was alive as well, will be decided by a court of six unless we cannot achieve four votes. So that means the matters that you're going to present to us will be decided by the justices that are seated here today. In the event that we deadlock on your case or any other case, the new Chief Justice will review the briefs, watch the video, and decide, is that enough to cast a vote, or should the case be re-argued? So it is possible that you could be asked to a do-over. It is unlikely, but that remains a possibility. We will continue to decide cases in the normal course, and the announcement of opinions will spin out in the normal course. So with that, I believe we're ready to begin. The case before us is 9-1418, Richard Cordray, Attorney General of the State of Ohio, versus the International Preparatory School et al. For the Attorney General, Mr. Marty.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, the light will come on at 2, so if you see the yellow light, otherwise you've got to watch your time yourself.
Very good, Your Honor. This case will decide whether one very large body of taxpayer dollars will receive the same level of protection as all other public funds. Until the decision below, all funds flowing into a public body in Ohio were protected by the strict liability of the official with ultimate responsibility for the body's funds. The decision below created a categorical exception to that rule for charter schools, schools that receive about $750 million in public funding every year. We submit that the lessening of protection that results from that can't be squared with either the specific statutes that control such matters or the general well-being of Ohio's charter school program. So we therefore ask this court to hold that charter school officials are indeed public officials and that they're just as accountable for the funds flowing into their schools as the officials of traditional schools or other public bodies. Let's turn first to the controlling law. Revised Code Section 9.39 codifies about 150 years of Ohio common law that holds that public officials are strictly liable for all losses of public funds occurring on their lot, on their watch, regardless of whether they were personally involved with that loss. Revised Code Section 9.38 tells us who's subject to that rule by adopting the definition of public official set out in 11701. And that is basically a two-element definition, whether the person is an officer of a public office. We submit that community school treasurers fit comfortably within both of those elements. It's pretty well established that a treasurer is considered to be an officer. If you look at the law dictionaries, the general dictionaries, they both define a treasurer as the officer responsible for an organization's funds. Further, the revised code refers to treasurers as officers in a wide variety of contexts in both public and private bodies. So I think the first element is pretty clearly established. The second element is also established, and that is whether community schools are public offices. 11701D identifies two types of bodies that are public offices. One is a political subdivision. Another is an entity established by Ohio law to perform a governmental function, and community schools are both. This court in Ohio Congress held that community schools are not mere corporations, but instead they're among the class of political subdivisions that may receive public financial support, state financial support, under Ohio's Constitution. That's at paragraph 72.
That opinion also said that it is a public school. The charter school is a public school.
Indeed, and that reflects the plain language of 3314.01b. That's correct, Your Honor.
Did the trial court conclusively establish whether or not she was a treasurer of the school versus a treasurer of the corporation?
Well, to be honest with you, Your Honor, that really wasn't much of an issue in the trial court. Let me answer your question directly. No, they didn't make a direct finding on that. But I guess I'd respond to your question about whether we need to make a finding on two levels. First of all, we don't know whether that fact is material until you tell us what the law is regarding charter school status as public officials. That needs to be resolved one way or the other.
But even if we find that treasurers are public officials subject to the requirements of other public school treasurers, doesn't that still need to be a factual finding that we would have to send it back down for? Because they're alleging she only was treasurer to the corporation, and you're alleging she was treasurer to the school, and you say the court didn't really conclusively decide that.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would respond in two ways. First of all, as a matter of law, we don't think you can distinguish between the corporation and the school. They're one and the same. Ohio law requires that the schools be corporations. So if you're an officer of the corporation, you're an officer of the school. As a matter of fact, we specifically pled in our amended complaint that TIPS was a public school and that Ms. Shabazz was TIPS treasurer. Those allegations were not denied, and therefore under Rule 8D, those facts are established. So I don't think there is a fact question. But in the event that you disagree with me on that, which I hope you don't, I would suggest that you answer the broader question of whether they are public officials and remand. But again, we don't think a remand is necessary. So let me go back to the public official test. As I mentioned before, Ohio Congress found them to be political subdivisions and hence a public office. There are several provisions of the revised code that expressly describe them as political subdivisions. And other courts have looked at Ohio Congress, have looked at those statutes, and come to the conclusion that they're political subdivisions for other purposes. There's no law to the contrary. So we think that it's pretty clearly established that they're subdivisions that make some public offices. But if you don't agree with me on that, there are clearly entities that are established by Ohio law to perform a governmental function. They're established by Chapter 3314 of the revised code. They don't exist without that law. And they perform K-12 education, a classic governmental function. So that's an alternate basis for finding them to be a public office. So the result is that they fit within the statutory definition of a public office, We therefore submit that they are subject to the same rules of strict liability as any other public official or any public treasurer. We don't believe that that's changed by any of the statutes that Ms. Shabazz or her amici point to. Most prominent among those is 1702.55. Now, that statute does immunize corporate officers from liability on, quote, obligations of the corporation, close quote. But that's not what we're talking about here. Instead, we're talking about Mrs. Shabazz's personal individual obligation to preserve and protect and maintain the body's funds. This court in Eshelby described a treasurer as a custodian. In Harper and in the First District's decision in Bolzinger, treasurers are described as the insurer of the integrity of the fund. In this situation, you had a situation where state funds flowed into TIPS. They should have been preserved to be paid back to the state, but they're gone. The treasurer's duty is to prevent that from happening. So what we're doing is we're enforcing that distinct obligation. Furthermore, we don't think that there's anything in the charter school laws that changes that outcome. Those laws are set out in Chapter 3314 of the revised code. And there's nothing in there that provides a blanket immunization of charter school officials from generally applicable legal obligations.
Counsel, that's what I wanted to ask. In Ohio Congress, we went through the statute establishing charter schools and noted that there was certain flexibility that the legislature had built in to their operation. But in your research, you see nothing that would impact upon a treasurer's duties or obligations?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I see something that I think would support the proposition that they have the same generally applicable obligations as other folks. Section 3314.071 immunizes charter school officials from one small subset of liability, contractual liability. Nothing else is covered in terms of immunization. Now, why would the legislature have to put that specific provision in there if the default rule is that there's no liability in general? So it's our position that the decision below can't be squared with the controlling statutes, and we think it ought to be reversed on that basis alone. Always gets a little bit dangerous when we get into public policy, but let me submit something else. The charter school program in Ohio can only work if we make sure that the money that's devoted to that goes for the purpose it's intended to go for. We're talking about $750 million of public funding every year. If those officials that run those schools are not as accountable for those as every other public official, human nature is going to take over, and some of that money is going to go where it shouldn't. And we think the best way to prevent that from happening and the best way to strengthen the charter school program is to hold them just as accountable as any other public treasurer. And I have run out of things to say unless there
Council,
are questions.
Let me ask you whether I have this correctly understood. The allegation is that they inflated their enrollment records in order to receive funding that they were not entitled to receive.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it's not a matter of receiving, so there's an allegation of fraud here that goes beyond just misspending funds.
Well, the auditor found that they received $1.4 million more than they shouldn't because they inflated their enrollment figures. The finding that we're suing to recover on is set forth in page 107 of the supplement, and it talks about money being deposited into the school's account. That those money should have been returned, but they were not remitted. So it's a question of preserving and returning this money that the school wasn't entitled to. So, and Ms. Shabazz's failure to keep those funds intact is what we're suing over.
And that's, I guess, my point. They're not taking money that they were entitled to receive based on their head count or their enrollment and then just not spending it for school purposes. They never should have gotten the money to begin with.
That's correct. And we don't know where this money is.
Council, help me understand how this works with respect to charter schools. Do they get a lump sum per capita payment based on number of students?
They get a set figure per student is dispersed monthly.
But it is based, in other words, the state money. We're talking about the state money.
Correct,
and it's the state money that you've feel is entitled to be, they're entitled to be treated as any other public body in terms
correct.
Of audit function, those kind of things. The state money itself comes to charter schools. If you are a charter school going through the hoops to establish that you are, it comes to you on a per capita basis. That's
correct.
It. It's correct. Not program related or anything else.
Well, I should say they are supplemented by certain grants. And okay. but the basic, the bulk of the funding is the per student state operating.
And it's what's in play here is basically that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right.
Yes.
There's also a considerable amount of state funds that go to the Catholic schools.
I believe that's correct as well, Your Honor.
Is the state same? Take the same position with respect to the Catholic schools?
No, I think there's several statutory elements that are missing here. First of all, we're not talking about a political subdivision or a public office there. So I don't think we can characterize
it. Doesn't that go out on a per capita basis as well?
Well, but the statutory test looks at the nature of the officer and the nature of the body that that officer serves. In that case, you'd be talking about an employee of a private organization. So I don't think you can fit that within the statutory framework.
Okay, I'm still lost as
okay,
the difference.
Let me try that again. I apologize, Your Honor.
Yeah, well,
our claim to public official status is based upon the definition in 117.01. And there's two criteria. You're a public official, and you're a public official of a public office. Well, we don't think that parochial schools would be a public office. I mean, they're a private entity that, you know, is not dependent upon the state to exist. They're created of their own energy. So that statutory element would be gone. I don't think it would apply to that.
And the charter schools are different in that regard.
They are, because as this court recognized in Ohio Congress, they're political subdivisions. Furthermore, unlike a parochial school, they're established pursuant to a specific body of state law. A parochial school is established because some folks get together and think that's a good area of ministry and put their energy into it. So that's the distinction, Your Honor.
If a parochial school, though, and I believe some of them do, function as a charter school?
I don't believe that's possible under Ohio law.
It's not?
No, they have to be secular, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, the law requires that treasurers in traditional public school have a bond, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does the law require the same thing for the treasurer of a community school?
It does. In this case, however, the bond disappeared, which was sort of typical of TIP's chaotic organizational structure. But it's important to note that the bond is only one means of recovery. All these public official cases that this court has decided over the years came up in situations where those public officials were protected by a bond as well. But nonetheless, the court held that the public's entitled to an additional level of protection in terms of looking to the official as well as the bonding company. And indeed, in Seward, this case, court rejected the proposition that public officials have to look at any particular public bodies need to look at any particular remedy. Instead, it recognized that the public has the discretion and the freedom to look to any possible source of recovery. I have no further questions.
Mr. Marty, do we have any case that would hold a treasurer of a public school? I don't know if that official exists, but do we have anything that holds a treasurer of a public school strictly liable?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We have two cases to that effect. The first is Eshelby that this court decided early in the 20th century. And I'm not certain about this, but I think the first district's decision in Bolsinger also involved school funds. It was actually a municipal treasurer, but I think under the unique situation of that municipality, I think he was also the treasurer for the school district. But I'm not certain about that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Marty. Mr. Brent Horton, representing the International Preparatory School, which is abbreviated down to TIPS. Is that correct?
Actually, it is not correct, Your Honor. Okay. I do not represent the International Preparatory School. I represent Hasina Shabazz.
Okay.
The International Preparatory School was represented by other counsel in these proceedings. Justice Pfeiffer, justices of the court, may it please the court. I think the first thing we need to take a look at is the application of Revised Code Section 9.39. Specifically looking at the 150-year history as to how it and its predecessors in common law have been applied, it's been applied in very limited circumstances. Typically, it has been applied where a public official has been a custodian of funds, and those funds have either been stolen or there's been a shortage. Specifically, there was one case cited by the appellant where a public official took home $2,000 of public funds to his residence. The residence was broken into, and therefore the state tried to hold the public official accountable. The public official took the position that, look, you know, I was not responsible for the break into my home, therefore I have no liability. The court said essentially, no, we're going to hold you strictly liable because if we did not do that, it could be subject to fraud. So essentially, the only time that you see 9.39 applied is when there's like a shortage of funds or where, for instance, we collected $10 and there's only $8 in the account. Or if there's been an illegal expenditure of funds, such as in Hebert, where the state treasurer, well, specifically his subordinate, made payments that were contrary to what the statute is. The reading that the appellants gave of 9.39 is overbroad and is not supported by any case law.
There's an audit that has been done that established that there was a irregularity in the use of the receipt and the use of these dollars, correct?
Incorrect, Your Honor. The audit essentially indicates that the enrollment figures which were submitted were inaccurate. And in response to those enrollment figures, monies were paid that should not have been paid. There is no finding. In fact, the audit is silent, the record is silent, as to what happened once those monies have been paid.
Okay, but there is no dispute that the enrollment figures were inflated. They were inaccurate, and as a result, dollars flowed that should not have to this organization. You didn't challenge the audit on that, did you?
In response to Justice Pfeiffer, as I indicated, we did not represent the International Preparatory School. They were represented by other counsel. You are correct in that the community school did not challenge that particular finding from the audit.
Okay, so I guess my question is, how is that different than how you preface the application of the statute by saying it only applies in these certain circumstances when there's a shortage or there's, you know, misappropriated funds? What's different about what happened in the situation for this charter school with the examples that you have given?
Correct. The conduct which is complained of by the state of Ohio is not once the money has been paid, it was the inflated enrollment figures. The proximate cause, which it was the inflated enrollment figures which led to the money being paid.
And the money was being paid, and there were no students there to benefit per capita from these dollars. So this money was not spent on students. So isn't it a logical conclusion that the money was fits the criteria that where a treasurer would be held liable?
Actually, I think that's incorrect. I believe the money probably was used for typical operating expenses for a school, paying overhead, paying for staff, paying rent, and those type of things. The record did not really go into that, but there is no finding that the money was used for inappropriate purposes. One of the cases which is probably most on point would be State v. Hale. State v. Hale dealt with when a commissioner submitted false payroll information the executive director of the commission submitted false payroll information, which resulted in excessive payments to commissioners. That was not a strict liability case and was not decided under Revised Code Section 9.39, but they did find that the executive director was liable because it was a breach of his public duty.
Are you claiming that the audit did not demonstrate that any of the principals in this corporation took money home personally or put money on personal expenses or that sort of thing? Is that what you're saying is the distinction?
Correct. There is no allegation that the money was used inappropriately once the money was paid.
The audit shows that there was an overinflated figure for enrollment, but you're claiming, does the audit demonstrate that those extra monies were spent still on school activities and school students, even though it was more than they were entitled to?
The audit is silent on that. It does not speak to that at all. There's nothing in the record which speaks to how the money was spent. Presumably, it was spent on typical operating expenses for a community school.
Is it your view that your client had nothing to do with originating the money, or is it your view that your client is not a public official?
Both, Your Honor. I think the record is clear that there were specific individuals who were hired to prepare and submit the enrollment information, and that was not Ms. Shabazz, was not one of those officials. We also dispute that Ms. Shabazz is a public official. I mean, I think it was indicated earlier, there is some dispute as to whether Ms. Shabazz was the treasurer of the school. There are two treasurers. There's the treasurer of the board and the treasurer of the school. Ms. Shabazz was merely the treasurer of the board. The treasurer of the school was held by another individual. And he's the one who managed the day-to-day operations along with the financial administrator.
Did the board receive the money, or did the treasurer of the school receive the money?
I believe it would have been the treasurer of the school is the one who manages the day-to-day operations along with the financial administrator as well as the bookkeeper.
Well, wouldn't the money from the state come to the board of the corporation, which is the one that actually operates the school? Wouldn't that be the legal direction that the funds would flow?
Well, the day-to-day operations were not handled by the board.
Well, I understand that they've delegated that to somebody else to do, but under the law, the board is the school, or is responsible for operating the school, is it not? And so wouldn't the funds be go to the board of the corporation, and then the board of the corporation would hand them out to the other school officials to expend for the operations of the school?
I don't know if there's that distinction between the board and the rest of the school. I mean, I believe it was paid into a school account. I don't believe that there was a separate account for the board, if I understand your question correctly.
All right.
But once again, if you look at 9.39, it generally applies to if there's been a theft or a failure to account for funds, or if there's been some type of illegal expenditure. There are no allegations like that in this case. The conduct which is complained of by the state is basically the enrollment figures that were submitted, and essentially, if in fact there is to be some claim that is brought, you know, it would have to be shown that those figures were somewhat fraudulently or negligently submitted, and that would be the proximate cause of the damages. Ms. Shabazz was not responsible for that, and therefore cannot have any liability for that.
Mr. Horton, the first sentence of 939 says, all public officials are liable for all public money received or collected by them or by their subordinates under the color of office. And I know you're talking about this school is closed, is it not?
Mm-hmm. That would be correct.
Okay, so the financial problems that the school had, I mean, whether the money was overinflated to begin with or the figures overinflated to begin with, there was money that was received, that was wrongfully received, whether it was spent on the children or by individuals really doesn't matter, because strict liability suggests if it was wrongfully received, that's the problem right there.
I would say that would be in conflict with State v. Hale. In State v. Hale, they looked at the conduct which led to the overpayment of funds. There is no case law or any legal authority which indicates that the treasurer of a school has some type of duty to preserve funds that they do not know have been wrongly received.
Well, if we find that your client was a public official at a public institution or a public office, then we are talking strict liability, aren't we?
No. The strict liability is only in limited circumstances, Your Honor. And the case law essentially indicates that is where there is a shortage in the account, or there's been some type of theft of funds, or there's been some type of illegal expenditure, such as making an expenditure which is contrary to the statute. There is no...
So you're saying it does not fit wrongful or money that should not have been received. That's your position.
Correct. And I think it's been the position of the state. The premise that all public officials are not strictly liable in all circumstances.
You're saying they're not all strictly liable for a loss. In other words, if a public official that is responsible for dollars and the money is lost in a fire, for example, on the premises of the school, or then that public official is not responsible for that loss. Correct?
Correct. And beyond that, if you look at Crane Township involved a case where the county commissioners signed checks in blank, gave them to a official, and this official subsequently misappropriated funds. That was not a strict liability case, and they found that there was malfeasance in office, that there was some type of breach of duty.
If you look at... They found that there was a breach of duty?
Correct.
Against
the county commissioners for signing the checks in blank and being
negligent in their disbursement of those checks.
Correct. If we look at State v. Hale, once again, that was not strict liability. What the case looked, what the courts looked at, is they looked at the conduct which led to it and made a determination that there was a breach of the duty.
So you're saying even if your client is found to be a public official, she is not responsible for inflating the enrollment, the receipt of the dollars, and the expenditure of those dollars, no matter, even though you don't know where those dollars went?
That would be correct. I mean, if the state wants to pursue, there is no finding here that there's been any type of misappropriation of funds or any type of misuse of funds. She can't be held liable if there's been no finding.
Well, aren't they saying that she never should have gotten the money in the first place, so any use of those dollars would have been wrong?
No, they have not.
That's like saying that I've got a checking account, and I look one day at my statement, and, oh, my God, somebody mistakenly gave me, you know, an extra $50,000. And I hurry up and spend that, and I'm not liable to return that money?
Well, I think there are some distinctions between your hypothetical and the situation in this matter. One, Ms. Shabazz was not the one who was responsible for the submission of the enrollment information. So she would not have any personal knowledge that information was incorrect. Once again, she was not the treasurer of the school who was managing the day-to-day operations of the school as well.
But she was the treasurer of the corporation that was responsible for establishing the school.
Correct. She was the treasurer of the board of the corporation. There was a separate position of a treasurer.
For
the school, who managed the day-to-day operations of the school, along with the financial administrator and a bookkeeper.
And did that treasurer of the school submit the inflated information to the state?
No, I don't believe that information came from the treasurer. I think there were other individuals who were hired whose duties included that, who made those submission of those reports. I think the facts will show that there was the office of the treasurer was not involved at all.
So the board, the members of the board, had no idea that these numbers were inaccurate?
That is correct.
Did your client make expenditures as treasurer of the board? As treasurer, your client presumably had control of a checkbook.
That is correct. I'm sure.
So she wrote checks.
I'm sure that she did, Your Honor.
And is the $1.4 million that's involved here money that flowed through that checking account?
I mean, to answer your question honestly, Your Honor, we have never got to that point as to, yeah, did she write some checks? I'm sure that she did. Can I tell you and specifically say that it was part of that $1.4 million? That has never been established, and I do not know that for sure. I mean, it is a possibility.
Red light's on. Thank you. Mr. Horton. Mr. Marty, you've got a little less than a minute.
I will be quick. Three basic points. The question of the scope of the strict liability is answered by this court's decision in Seward. The only exceptions recognized are acts of God and a public entity. We're not talking about either of those here. With regard to other employees and their involvement, 9.39 expressly deals with other employees. Final point, regardless, if you feel there's some fact question, remand, but establish the rule of law. This program needs to be policed, and a firm rule of law is the best way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Marty. The case is submitted. The students and I believe you lawyers have agreed to spend a little time with them, so you get to do a question and answer now with the attorneys on this case. We'd love to be in the room and hear your questions and their answers, but you will get to do that, and we hope that's an important part of this teaching experience. We've enjoyed having you here today.